Indiana Jones and his leather bullwhip were no match for stylish shoes and cocktails. We all knew that women all over America were gearing up for the movie based on the HBO series Sex and the City. It opened over the weekend, and it blew away box office expectations, taking in more than $55 million. Anthony Brooks sampled some of the Sex and the City hype.
Well, I'm here at the Regal Cinema on a Saturday evening, not far from NPR headquarters on 7th Street here in Washington, D.C. And this is the 7 p.m. showing of Sex and the City.
6:15, 6:30, 7:01, 7:30.
Most of the people here are white women, I'd say in their 30s. They've dressed up pretty stylishly for this show. And there's a lot of excitement to see this movie.
Well, I just love the show.
This is Sarah Craighill of Annapolis, Maryland. She's here for the big movie, which picks up where the TV series left off 4 years ago. It follows the adventures of the oh-so-fashionable Carrie Bradshaw, played by Sarah Jessica Parker, and her three New York pals in their frank talk about sex, love, men, and friendship. Again, Sarah Craighill.
It was so much fun, and they would say the things that you were always sort of thinking but never really felt comfortable saying. I think of the absurdity that we all experience, and sometimes you feel like you're alone in it, but actually they brought it to the surface in a way that made it hilarious and made that okay.
I think for me it was that, you know, I really have a lot of strong female friends.
This is Lauren Dekus of Washington, D.C.
And I saw a lot of my friends in the different characters on the show. So watching the show with those friends, you know, helped us bond even further.
So it was the model of friendship that you
exactly.
Wanted.
Exactly. Yeah. And the drinking.
Sex and the City was lavishly promoted with an enormous pent-up fan base. But this past weekend's excitement caught many industry experts by surprise.
This is just something that was way underestimated.
Paul Daragarabedian is a box office analyst in Southern California.
You know, this is a cultural phenomenon. If you look at the box office numbers, it shows you that women wield a tremendous amount of clout at the box office.
That's not to say there weren't a few men who ran out to see the movie as well.
I'm excited to see it.
This is Edward Allen, a fashion coordinator for Nordstrom's.
The TV show changed the way America dressed, quite honestly. It really showed about mixing high and low. I'm dying to see where they take the story, but honestly, I'm here for the visual candy.
Okay, well, I've come around the other side of the Regal Theater, and I'm waiting at the bottom of the escalator, and the 4:30 movie is just getting out now, and I'm going to find out what people thought about it.
I loved it. I thought it was smart and funny, and it was the first chick flick I've ever seen that didn't talk to me like an idiot.
That rave from Mackenzie Vershaw of Washington, D.C. Stephanie Stymitz and Irina Smotrich agreed and say too few movies focus on female friendships.
They try to show that there's women's friendship and that's the main focus, but it's not. There's very few shows and movies that are about it.
A lot of them focus on the men and the relationship with the women, and the friendship is always a side story. This, because it's been going on for so long, I mean, the men have come and gone, the drinks have come and gone, the random nights have come and gone, but the friendships have always been there the whole time.
Given all the excitement, it's probably safe to expect a sequel. So coming soon, more Sex and the City. Anthony Brooks, NPR News, Washington.
There's a war happening in Tarakistan. Now, before you go checking your atlas, Tarakistan is a fictional country. Well, sort of. Tarakistan's the setting for a new film, War Incorporated. It's a satire that tells the story of a war fought and managed by private defense contractors.
When did they start attacking inside the Emerald City?
I wouldn't call that an attack. Well, technically that was a bombing. At least it sounded like it was. Not an attack, which would imply something else.
That's actor John Cusack, who plays a morally conflicted hitman for the company in charge of running Tarakistan. He's there ostensibly to help organize a freewheeling commercial trade show. Now, John Cusack didn't just star in the film. He co-wrote the script and helped fund the production. Cusack also recruited some of Hollywood's top talent, including Dan Aykroyd, Ben Kingsley, Marissa Tomei, and teen idol Hilary Duff. He joins us now on the line from London. Mr. Cusack, welcome.
Hi.
Before I ask you a question about the film, I want to play a brief clip. We're going to hear Dan Aykroyd in this clip. He plays the vice president, the former vice president of the United States in the film, and he now heads a fictional defense contractor. It's called Tamerlane, and they're rebuilding Tarakistan. And in this scene, Tamerlane is preparing to hold a commercial expo in a protected part of Tarakistan. Let's take a quick listen.
This is a historic moment, Hauser. The first war ever to be 100% outsourced to private enterprise. Tamerlane jets, Tamerlane tanks, Tamerlane soldiers, and to top it all off, the brand USA Expo.
John Cusack, to say the least, this is not a subtle film you made. Why did you decide to go with satire?
Well, I think, there's a large and glorious tradition of satire and comedy and absurdist comedy making fun of power elites and aristocracies, and I think in the modern or postmodern world, these people are kind of corporate titans, you know? So it just seemed like the situation has gotten so grave, and the ideology behind this war is so radical, and it's so destroying the country that I think a somber, serious take on it would just add to the sense of depression and inevitable doom that this administration has unleashed on the country. So I think sometimes when you put an absurdist lens on it, maybe you can see it a little bit more clearly and you can recapture your sort of sense of defiance and your spirit of outrage. And also, you know, what is absurdism but taking the current trends to their logical conclusions? Mm-hmm. And the argument of the Bush administration is that there's nothing, no function of state, there is no national interest that is not a corporate interest. Everything is to be privatized. Everything is to be the core function of government is to create the optimal conditions for a feeding frenzy.
I've been to Iraq many, many times myself as a correspondent. And even though this film is obviously over the top, I was struck at how frighteningly familiar some of the scenes appeared, sort of the interaction between the contractors and the locals, and the interaction between the contractor and the journalist. What kind of research did you do to make this film?
Basically, I read everything I could and went through every independent news organizations and spoke with people who have been on the ground there, really tried to research it as much as I could. And when you get into that research, you realize that it's really beyond anything that you could imagine. It's so kind of savage and absurd.
John Cusack, talk to me a little bit about some of the obstacles that you faced in making this film. I mean, obviously, this is a very political film. It's overt, and you're trying to send a message. I imagine you faced some pushback.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you face the pushback, you know, in an overt way. I think people just try to ignore what you're saying and hope that you'll go away and won't choose to do it. And certainly we didn't get any corporate backing, and none of the studios wanted to do it. But we did find a company that would do it. So we did it for a very small budget and shot it in Bulgaria.
In the film, there are a lot of corporate logos, familiar ones, Coca-Cola, Popeye's Chicken, Financial Times. Did you have to get permission to use those?
We did, but we just sort of sent out the most innocuous sort of form letter we could, and we hoped that people would, that the corporations would think, well, any press is good press, and or maybe they wouldn't read about what the movie's about. And so we just kept sending out form letters until we got back yeses, and we got yeses from those companies, so we used them. But I have to say, the Financial Times on the tank was one of our proud satiric accomplishments, because you know, after all, those papers like the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times called Iraq a gold rush, and I think they were being quite accurate. You know, you build a frontier, because it's the most profitable thing you can do, and a gold rush is a feeding frenzy.
There's a particularly tough scene in the film. It's where a group of dancers, can-can girls, are rehearsing for a performance, all of them with prosthetic limbs. Let's listen to that scene.
It's incredible. Each girl is a transfemoral amputee that lost a leg during the liberation.
And thanks to Tamerlane's cutting-edge prosthetic devices, we can literally have you up and dancing before you know it.
Just another breathtaking example of how American know-how alleviates the suffering it creates.
John Cusack, it's a pretty shocking scene. Why did you put it in the film?
Well, I think it's a mistake to think that comedy or humor or satire is supposed to just make you laugh. It's supposed to also make you think, and it's okay to make you feel uncomfortable. So I think you have to start with that premise.
Why are you trying to tell this story now? I mean, the tide has turned in the United States. The war is overwhelmingly unpopular. What's the point of doing it now?
Well, I don't know. You know, when we conceived this, it was at the height of actually the war's popularity. And, you know, people were standing at podiums and lecterns saying, you know, people better watch what they say. And they were giving all these kind of McCarthyite warnings. So I think it came out of a sense of outrage. Mm. And I would say I don't relish sort of being an activist, not sort of something that I would want to do. But I think in 2008, being an activist is probably a pretty decent position to take if you want to sleep at night.
Well, John Cusack, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
John Cusack is the co-writer and the star of the film War Incorporated. He spoke to us from London.
The online movie rental company Netflix may not know when you're sleeping or know when you're awake, but they sure do track and sort the rental preferences of their subscribers. And now their website can show you what members are renting by city or zip code. So, are video tastes on the Upper West Side of Manhattan notably different from those in Manhattan, Kansas? We asked Murray Horowitz, the director and chief operating officer of the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center, and both an opera librettist and a former NPR executive before he went off to the Cayman Islands with our travel budget to scroll through some of those Netflix selections. He joins us in our studio.
Promise not to tell. He's like,
Murray, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here, Scott, as always. Thanks so much for having me.
What do you notice?
First of all, we have to get the ground rules straight. It says at the top, members in and around your town here are currently renting these titles much more than other Netflix members. It's not the most rented. I'm sure everybody's renting, you know, Spider-Man 3 and The Bourne Ultimatum and No Country for Old Men. It's just that these films are more rented in this town than they are in other towns.
Yeah.
And the pattern that emerged is people are really parochial. It started out in Washington, right?
Yeah.
Among the first five films in Washington are K Street, the complete series.
Gosh, of course, yeah.
And Goodbye, Lenin. And then Our Brand is Crisis, which is about, you know, political imaging. And even on the
list. Oh, this is real imaginative. You know what I'm Washington saying? Filmgoers, yeah.
Number 11,
yeah.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Oh, my gosh. It's like a tribute, though, to a great film.
So friend. I figured, okay, look, what's the city with the reputation, at least, for being the most sophisticated? So I go up I-95 or up the Amtrak railway to New York, New York.
Yeah.
Number one, next stop, Greenwich Village. Number two, Barefoot in the Park. So then I figure, okay, I'm looking in the wrong places. You know, Billings, Montana, Casper, Wyoming. Comanche Moon, The Road to Lonesome Dove. It's like Broken Trail, the TV's also with Robert Duvall. And so I decided you and I have hometowns. I decided we'd put
both
our hometowns
both in the Midwest,
yeah. Dayton, Ohio, and Chicago, Illinois. Yeah. So I decided to go head-to-head with you. Yeah. I'm going to read to you now the first five films that members in and around Chicago, Illinois are currently renting more than other Netflix members.
Yeah.
H.H. Holmes, America's First Serial Killer, which is about
Chicago.
Chicago. Expo, Magic of the White City, about
Chicago.
Wicker Park.
Chicago.
Call Northside 777.
Jimmy Stewart Chicago movie, yes.
The Blues Brothers.
All right.
So then I go to Dayton, right?
Finally.
Multiplicity, Holes, Wedding Days, Robots, and Ladder 49. And I was completely befuddled. Either Dayton is as eclectic and inclusive and democratic as I want to believe it always has been, or this is all completely meaningless.
Murray Horowitz, Director and Chief Operating Officer at the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center.
James Bond never gets old, but will be marking a sort of milestone in the life of the super spy, the 100-year anniversary of the birth of Ian Fleming, the man who created Bond. To mark the occasion, a new Bond book is being issued, even though Fleming died in 1964. NPR's Rob Gifford went to the Imperial War Museum in London. An exhibition called, what else, For Your Eyes Only, is commemorating all things 007.
It's a journey back in time at the Imperial War Museum right now, not so much a spin through the Bond movies as through the life of Bond's inventor, Ian Fleming, the music of the time and the influences that led to his most famous creation, told through an interview he gave in 1963.
I was just on the edge of getting married, and I was frenzied at the prospect of this great step in my life after having been a bachelor for so long, and I really wanted to take my mind off the agony. And so I decided to sit down and write a book.
The book was Casino Royale, published in 1952. An initial print run of just under 5,000 books had, within the 12 years before Fleming's death, become a franchise that had sold nearly 40 million copies. Tame by today's standards, the Bond books back then were considered very racy, though not by the standards of Fleming's own private life.
All history is sex and violence. And I think it's ridiculous to go on writing thrillers in the old Bulldog Drummond, John Buchan way when life has come out so fast past us. If I didn't
care. Fleming himself was born into privilege. Just before World War II, he joined British Naval Intelligence, and his experiences there, plus his own flamboyant lifestyle, gave him the perfect basis for Bond, who injected an unthinkable glamour into the austerity years of post-war Britain. Fleming denied that there was much of himself in James Bond.
I hope not. People do connect me with James Bond simply because I happen to like scrambled eggs and short-sleeved shirts and some of the things that James Bond does, but I certainly haven't got his guts nor his very lively appetites.
In fact, James Bond and Ian Fleming seem wholly intertwined, and the exhibit displays love letters and details of Fleming's affairs and a whole array of articles and letters from Fleming's life, as well as a rogues gallery of Bond villains and pictures of all the Bond girls. There have been other ghost authors writing as Ian Fleming before, but still, the idea of Sebastian Foulkes taking on the mantle in the new Bond novel Devil May Care doesn't sit well with museum visitor Benedict Flirter.
Since he drew most of the inspiration from his like childhood, from his time at war and so on, that actually this new author that's going to write it can't really like write it the same style and the same way as Ian Fleming did, because he's just from a totally different background. And since James Bond really seems to be like more or less like the alter ego Ian Fleming always wanted to be, this person won't be able to do it.
But Anne and Jason Innes, visiting from Dallas, Texas, say they'll give it a try.
Why not? I mean, as long as it's not misrepresented, sure.
Yeah, I say go for it. He's a great character and we need more of it.
The book is out exactly 100 years after the day Ian Fleming was born, and the public can decide for themselves. Rob Gifford, NPR News, at the Imperial War Museum in London.
A new box set of five famous movies starring Joan Crawford has just been released on DVD. But classical music critic Lord Schwartz says that one of those films, which he's wanted to see for years, is probably famous for the wrong reasons.
A new DVD has been making me think about the connection between the way performers look and the way they sound. Because of the way music gets recorded on film, most of the singing in movie musicals is pre-recorded and lip-synced by the star miming the motions. If it's the right voice, the dubbing can be electrifying. Rita Hayworth's mock striptease to Put the Blame on Mame in the film noir Gilda became her iconic image, even though she didn't actually sing the song. She was lucky that her singing voice belonged to the wonderful Anita Ellis, who sounded as glamorous and witty as Hayworth looked. Marnie Nixon's ladylike, trained operatic voice, complete with British accent, was the perfect counterpart for Deborah Carr in The King and I. But in My Fair Lady, all the character drained from the songs when Nixon sang for Audrey Hepburn, whose own voice was so distinctive and endearing. The musical melodrama Torch Song, starring Joan Crawford, not known for her singing, has just come out on DVD. Crawford plays a hard-bitten Broadway musical star. But she was not as lucky as Rita Hayworth. The uncredited singer dubbing her voice has some of the hard-edged qualities of Crawford's speaking voice, and Crawford's lip-syncing is quite expert. But how could this possibly be the voice of a character who is idolized for her singing?
Follow me, and you'll have diamond starlight in your eyes. I'll take you places on a cloud. Beckon you to follow me.
The most poignant item on the Torch Song DVD is a bonus feature, a half-hour audio clip of an excruciating recording session in which Crawford actually tries to sing her own number. She had once taken lessons from the great American soprano Rosa Poncel, but she can barely hit the notes or stay in tune.
2541, take 6.
Follow me, and you'll have diamond starlight in your eyes. I'll take you places on a cloud of gold, and in your arms you'll hold a paradise. My smile will beckon you to follow me, and you will know the glow of ecstasy. You'll own the sun, the moon, the stars above. A world of love, if you will always follow me.
Any good?
There are a number of reasons Torch Song wasn't a hit. How could audiences be expected to accept Joan Crawford as a singer or dancer? In 1953, she still had great legs, and when she played flappers in the 1920s, she could really shake them. But she's almost as klutzy a dancer as she is a singer. Torch Song is probably most notorious for a preposterous production number called Two-Faced Woman, in which Crawford actually performs in blackface and dark body makeup. We can finally howl at this legendary camp classic in all its terrible, widescreen technicolor tastelessness.
I can't help being a two-faced woman. A little bit of boldness, a little bit of sweetness, a little bit of coldness, a little bit of heatness. Don't fall in love with a two-faced woman. I'm giving you a warning, I'll leave you in the morning. Got another lover undercover. I'm like a weather vane that goes with the breeze. My disposition makes me do as I please. That's why they call me.
Torch Song is actually a fast-moving soap opera about how a self-centered Broadway diva finds love with a blind ex-soldier and former theater critic, played by Michael Wilding, who was still Elizabeth Taylor's husband at the time. The film is smartly directed by Charles Walters, a dancer-choreographer who directed such entertaining musicals as Good News and Easter Parade. In the movie's most ironic scene, Walters himself plays Crawford's dancing partner, and she wants him fired because he trips over her when they're rehearsing a number. Torch Song is great fun to watch, but it's even more fun when it's bad than when it's good.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and co-editor of the new Library of America volume of Elizabeth Bishop's poems, prose, and letters.